From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Alex Gibney is a documentary filmmaker who thinks of his work as more than just a piece of visual journalism. He says they're movies, and so they have stories in them with good guys and bad guys and dramatic moments. Gibney even assigns a movie genre to his docs. The film he made about the corruption on Wall Street was a heist film. The piece he made about American torture practices, a murder mystery. And his latest, a documentary about the chronic sexual abuse of children by Catholic priests, is a crime story. And not just the crime of molesting a child. Gibney says the biggest crime is the way the Catholic Church has protected these priests and even covered up their actions. Today in the program, we continue our series Through the Lens. Alex Gibney will join us to talk about his film. It's called Mea Maxima Culpa, Silence in the House of God. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our series on documentaries with a powerful film about the chronic sexual abuse of children by Roman Catholic priests. It's Alex Gibney's film called Mea Maxima Culpa, Silence in the House of God. The film is built around one of these stories that played out in a Catholic school for the deaf in the 1960s and 70s, where a priest named Lawrence Murphy regularly abused the young boys there. The film is about how, when the boys became men, they chose to speak out. But it's also about the widespread problems of abuse that permeates the church. It's about how church officials protected these priests and covered up their crimes. Next week, we're screening the film. Today in the program, a conversation with Alex Gibney, who joined us earlier today. Gibney won an Academy Award in 2008 for his documentary Taxi to the Dark Side. Among his recent films is We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year. Mea Maxima Culpa premieres next week on HBO. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. I began our conversation by asking him, what is it that his films have in common?
Power.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, either an anatomy of power or sometimes a look at the abuses of power. I mean, that seems to be what I'm interested in. I say seems to be because, you know, that's a question. The question you ask is probably better addressed to you or anybody else. Sometimes I take on these films because I'm interested in them and I don't know precisely why. But it seems to be power and the abuse of power. That's what seems to turn my crank.
I know your father was a journalist. Your stepfather was a minister. And I guess that balance of power was something that was present in your life, was it, in those two figures or maybe others?
Well, look, I mean, as a journalist, you're perpetually curious. Yeah. And frankly, your role in society is to expose really abuses of power. And my stepfather was a kind of I guess you'd almost have to call him a crusading minister, not in the classic crusade sense, but in the sense of righting wrongs. I mean, he was a guy who was on the freedom rides. He was very much in the avant-garde of the anti-Vietnam War movement. In fact, he was tried with Dr. Spock for conspiracy, and also in the anti-nuclear movement. So he was very much a person who was all about public morality. He and my dad taught me a lot.
I wonder how you identify your documentaries, if you do. I mean, you talked about it being journalism, you being a journalist for sure, but you're also a filmmaker. So what, I guess, is it that this particular film, for example, is a personal portrait as much as it is an expose in some ways. So is the work you do kind of a mixture of those elements?
Look, I think, you know, I'm influenced by journalism, but I think that the films that I make are films. I see them as movies. And I approach them that way. You know, they're intended to be to have a kind of visual logic to them that hopefully, you know, transcends any easy kind of précis of what they're about. You know, there should be a reason why you watch them as opposed to just getting the PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah.
So I approach them as a filmmaker, really.
You've talked about this before, how your films often fit into a kind of genre, you know, mystery, or I think the Enron film you saw as a heist film. Maybe I read
Taxi
that
to the Dark Side, I think, was a murder mystery.
Murder mystery,
and,
right.
It was a murder mystery. Who killed Delawar?
Yeah.
The taxi driver. And I think that then in a way, this one is also mea maxima culpa is also a kind of mystery. It's like follow the money in a way, or let's look at the cover up. It's a little bit like the Watergate story in that sense.
Mm-hmm. That it's not so much about it is about the crime, but it's also about the effort to cover it up.
It's really about the cover up. I think the big crime here is the cover up. I mean, when I say that, I don't want to minimize, you know, the crime of somebody like Father Murphy who abused 200 deaf children. I mean, we can all agree that that's just horrific. And that's the act of a predator, but a disturbed predator. But I think what we have to be more upset about really is that the way the church as an organization has covered up for these predators for years and years and years. And that has to be the thing, you know, as a public that we have to be outraged about.
How did you get started with this project? What was the first story you heard?
I mean, the first story, honestly, was the newspaper article by Laurie Goodstein.
Yeah.
It was A1 in the New York Times. It was hard to miss. But there were two things about it that really struck me. One was that now there was a paper trail, which directly contradicted the Vatican's PR, you know, statements that they really didn't have any influence on the bishops. The bishops were on their own. Mm-hmm. But we see from this story and the documents that were exposed that actually the Vatican was very much running the show. Mm-hmm. So connecting this crime to the top, I mean really like Chinatown, following it all the way up to the top, that was really an interesting part of the story for me. The other thing about this story that I think engaged me was, you know, having looked at the dark side a lot, I was impressed by the heroes in this story, the deaf boys, then men, who were determined to have their voices heard despite the fact that so many people refused to listen. And they did, and they made a difference. And that, to me, was worth celebrating.
We should point out no current officials of the Catholic Church, not in the Vatican or here in the United States, were willing to speak to you to defend themselves or explain their positions. Why do you think that is?
I think because they don't feel that they're accountable. I mean, that would be my own personal impression. You know, they're satisfied with their positions of power. Why should they want to discuss an issue like this about the abuse of thousands of children with, you know, I'm getting a little bit sarcastic now, but honestly, I believe that they feel that, you know, they exist on a higher plane and they don't need to bother themselves with natty questions. As former Secretary of State Sodano said, petty gossip.
Yeah. We'll come back around to this question, but you don't get a sense they feel like the ground is shifting a bit under them, that they maybe should be saying something, they should be explaining themselves to documentarians, filmmakers like you?
You'd think they would.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, Timothy Dolan went on 60 Minutes, and actually we include a clip from that in the film. But, you know, there's a marked unreality about his perception of this issue. He says, on the whole, I think we handled this pretty well.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, most people would have to disagree. I don't think they handled it pretty well at all. And now we're seeing, you know, the more documents that are unearthed through these civil cases, the more egregious criminal cover-ups are being revealed. Now we see Cardinal Mahoney in Los Angeles. And through documents that were revealed through civil cases, we see a rather appalling pattern of moving priests around in order to protect them really and to shield the church from scandal. And you have to wonder, you know, what kind of organization would dedicate itself to making sure that criminals within were not only not prosecuted but also that victims were not protected. It's really shocking. So you'd have to wonder why they don't see themselves as needing some kind of truth and reconciliation commission, some disgorging of documents, some wholesale turning of the church hierarchy inside out to prove to people that they really do care about victims and survivors instead of just the power and prestige of the church.
You were raised Catholic, and I'm wondering what impact or what influence do you think that had on the way you you know, conceived of the film, the way you pursued the story. And I wonder, did it ever become personal for you in that way?
It is. I think it is personal for me. Yeah. And honestly, I'm not a practicing Catholic now. I don't go to Mass every Sunday. But as the priests will tell you, if we get them young, we never lose them. And in that sense, I do think of myself as Catholic. You know, I remarked to my wife one time. She took me to the church that she likes to go to, which is Protestant church. And I remember in one instance, everybody was saying the Lord's Prayer. And the Protestant version and the Catholic version are different.
Right.
And I remember, you know, insistently stopping at the end of the Catholic version, which is deliver us from evil.
Yeah.
And then, you know, letting everybody prattle on with the Protestant and add on, as I would, you know, define it.
Yeah.
I thought to myself, wait a minute, how peculiar is that? You don't go to church anymore, and yet somehow you're hanging on to this idea of the Catholic Church as the right and true church. So it's ingrained.
And mm-hmm.
But as part of that, I think the other thing that helped me in this film was that this is not a film that attacks the faith of Catholics in any way, shape, or form. This is a film that's about crime, and it's about the crime of the hierarchy and their willingness to aid and abet and cover up for pedophiles. That to me is something that, you know, needed. And by being Catholic then, I can separate those two rather than just sort of dismissively say, oh, that's those Catholics. And the fact is, while this is a film about Catholics, you know, the other thing I see in this film, and maybe other films that I've done have helped me in this, is that while it is about Catholicism and is directly about it, it also is tangentially about other institutions mm-hmm. who abuse their power. I mean, after all, we've seen it so recently, whether it be the BBC and Jimmy Savile, whether it be Penn State, mm-hmm. The Boy Scouts. It's everywhere. And where institutions are so much more concerned with protecting themselves than protecting victims of their crimes.
Yeah.
Wall Street would be another very good example.
And not only that, this attempt to protect their reputation, but also the fact that there are structures built into these institutions that really keep you from telling the truth about them, that this is a structural issue as much as anything as well.
That's intentional.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole idea is that you create a cover story. I mean, the word cover has a million different uses when we're talking about this kind of stuff. But there's always a cover story. I mean, Wall Street had to be saved because Wall Street was so important. And now, you know, as you dig into Wall Street and you realize the policies that were pursued in the wake of the bailout, you know, every step along the way was like, well, we can't do this because Wall Street would be upset, you know, because the status quo was somehow so important, and yet nobody cared that much about, you know, the people who lost their homes. That hasn't been as much of an issue because they don't have as much power and their cover story isn't nearly as good.
Mm. Well, you mentioned that it's a very personal profile of these men who were abused when they were young students at this Catholic school for the deaf in Milwaukee. It's a profile of them. And really how extraordinary it was for them at that particular time, we're talking about the 1970s, for them to come forward and say something. I want to mention their names because we have a few clips that I want to play where we'll hear them. Arthur Budzinski, Terry Cohout, Pat Keene, Bob Bolger, and Gary Smith. These are the everyday heroes that you were mentioning. And there's a powerful dimension in the film that I wanted to ask you about, and it's the way these men express themselves. And that visual language is really front and center in the film. The gestures are, you know, remarkably expressive. And I love how we can hear the sound that they make, you know, the claps and the whooshing of air as they communicate. I mean, you essentially mic'd deaf men.
I did. And I have to say, they were kind of incredulous. You know, we kept putting the mic closer and closer to them, and they were like, dude, what are you doing? We are deaf. And I had to explain to them that I felt it was important, you know, for the hearing audience to hear their struggles to communicate. And it actually made it rather complicated to shoot because I wanted this to be a conversation, not a series of questions with it, which would then have to be translated back and forth. You know, I wanted this to be kind of simultaneous. So I actually had to sit in a separate room, and we put a teleprompter housing over the barrel of one of the cameras. We shot these interviews with four cameras. And I had to sit in a separate room so that we could preserve the sound. And then they would look into the teleprompter, and what they'd see is the American Sign Language interpreter in the other room who had my ear. And so we were able to conduct a kind of simultaneous translation. But I worked very hard to try to present not only the sounds but also the visual imagery of this signing, which I found so expressive in such a wonderful language. It's like watching a magnificent animated film, really, and suddenly it's a film within a film because this language was just so expressive. And we also – there's one other little trick we used, which was to use a variable shutter on the camera so that you see a kind of flutter of their hands. So the hands then become much more present.
Wow.
So you're really brought into the world of their expressiveness, which I felt was so important in terms of, you know, having their voices heard, so to speak.
Well, it's hard to convey that in the radio, but I do want to play a clip that gives us a sense because we can hear that. And this also, I think, this illustrates a couple of things which I want to get to, but first we'll play this clip, and that is the fact that these are performed by actors, which we'll talk about. And then also you get a sense of their affection for, in this particular clip, we hear from Terry and Gary and Pat and Arthur talking about their affection for that school, which, again, I think is an important part. Here's a moment from the film.
When I first entered St. John's, I loved it. The campus of that school was beautiful. Such magnificent stonework. It was like a castle. I loved that school. Our school had a magnificent statue of Jesus Christ with his hands lovingly placed on the heads of two children. I could see that Jesus loved children, and the children loved Jesus too.
My name is Gary Smith. I was four in 1954, and I really liked being at school. I liked being in the dorm. The dorm was cooler than being at home with my parents because I didn't have any siblings.
When I first got to the school, I loved it because there were so many children around the same age as me who I could play with. And they were good people. It was a good group of friends.
In 1953, I was 4 years old. I remember when I got there, I couldn't stop crying. And I was looking up at a nun. She was wearing her white and black robes. I was looking at the nun, and my parents left.
From the film Mea Maxima Culpa, Silence in the House of God. So we're hearing actors. We're hearing Chris Cooper and Ethan Hawke and Jamie Sheridan and John Slattery there. And there's a theatrical element, I have to say, to the film, because the voiceovers, they're not just reading them.
They're performing them. Yeah, that's right. That's what I wanted them to do, because I wanted them to inhabit the role rather than translate. Because I wanted this to be an emotional experience. I wanted people to experience this as if they could sign, but you know, most of us in the hearing world can't.
Yeah.
So you know, that was intentional to use the actors in that way, and that's why we used voiceover also as opposed to doing subtitles. Because I didn't want people to be reading the subtitles. I wanted them to be looking at the faces and hands of the speakers.
Mm. You know, it's interesting. A.O. Scott of the New York Times in a review described your narration as – he said it was calm and angry, which made me wonder if you feel like you were part of that performance in any way, your part as narrator.
Maybe. I mean, you know, it's a weird thing, this business of me narrating. I mean, I joke that I do it because I'm cheap. I don't cost the production much, zero, except maybe in reputation. I handicapped the productions in that way. But I started it on Taxi to the Dark Side when I put my father in the film, and suddenly it became personal. And I do find that it helps to some extent when you're writing narration, and I don't write narration for all my films, but for many I do. Mm-hmm. That you know, when you know you're going to speak it yourself, there's a little bit more of your own voice in it that that comes through. And I think that's important, because then it's not the voice of God talking, it's mm-hmm. the voice of the author. And I think there's a very important difference.
We should mention there were I guess there were a few of the victims who hadn't spoken before. What was it like to convince them to go on camera? What was that like? And what kind of responsibility did you feel as you were talking to them and even as you were interviewing them?
I felt a tremendous responsibility. I mean, I treated it as a kind of a gift, you know, that they were allowing me to present them, because they were quite vulnerable. But at the same time, I think they reckoned with an awful truth, which was that by telling their stories, they were gaining a certain kind of freedom that they wouldn't otherwise have. That by keeping it all bottled up, it was actually eating away at them. So they needed to expel it. I mean, I keep hearing a Terry, as you can actually hear, I think at one point in the film, he goes, "Pah!" Oh, yeah. It's like he needed to get it out. And that turned out to be very important. So it was very wrenching for them to tell these stories, but important. And you know, you mentioned something earlier, which was the fact that I did probe them to talk about what they liked about the school, which was initially very hard to get them to do, because of course they were so angry. And also what they had liked and admired about Murphy, because actually Murphy, the priest, the predator priest, was a wonderful signer, very charismatic, as these people often are, and also a huge fundraiser for the school. I mean, he'd raised a lot of money to put this school on the map. But I felt it was really important to talk about, you know, their affection for that school early on, because it spoke to a certain kind of innocence that had been defiled. And you can't really know what kind of crime this is unless you see, feel, and hear that sense of innocence first.
Alex Gibney is with us. He directed and produced Mea Maxima Culpa, Silence in the House of God. It debuts Monday on HBO. Wednesday of next week, Radio West and the Utah Film Center is going to be presenting a free screening at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Alex Gibney will join us by Skype for a Q&A immediately following the film. For more information, you can visit our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We now continue our conversation with the filmmaker Alex Gibney. We recorded the conversation earlier today. Gibney has produced a documentary about the chronic abuse of children by Roman Catholic priests and the efforts to cover up the crimes. The film is called Mea Maxima Culpa, Silence in the House of God. Alex, I want to talk about Lawrence Murphy, the priest. How do you understand him? Because in some ways, he could be portrayed as this kind of one-dimensional sort of evil character. And maybe that's what you're left with. But how did you end up seeing Lawrence Murphy? And how did you want him to be conveyed? He's conveyed by others. But, I mean, how are you understanding him, I guess?
I think you have to understand how many of these people work. And when I say these people, I mean predators.
Yeah.
And predators, like Lawrence Murphy, tend to be guided by a compulsion that they can't control. And yet they manage to get access to their victims by putting themselves in either positions of power, authority, or community affection. You know, Murphy was not a kind of Snidely Whiplash character, you know, always followed by a shadow and bats hovering over his head. You know, he was a guy who was charismatic. He was a jokester. He was like I said before, he really could sign beautifully. And he raised tremendous amounts of money for the school. And so there was actually great affection for him, ironically enough, in the deaf community of Milwaukee and all around the Midwest, because this was a boarding school. People would come to that school from other places.
Right.
And so there was a lot of resistance to going after him when questions were raised. But this teaches us something really important and interesting about these institutions and what we have to look for, because, you know, bad things don't always come in bad packages. You know, institutions that are tremendously respectable are often the very places that criminals go to hide,
mm-hmm.
because they're protected by those reputations. And that's why we have to be ever vigilant. You know, so to understand the fact that Murphy was a kind of smiling, charismatic character is really terribly important.
The other context for this, of course, is that all of the boys had their reasons for keeping it secret at first. I mean, for Terry, he didn't want to hurt his mother, who had already gone through some incredible trauma. Gary and Pat had a difficult time actually communicating with their own parents. And in some weird sort of perverse twist, Lawrence Murphy is the guy helping them communicate with their own parents. So they're stuck. I mean, who are they going to talk to?
Yeah, I mean, I think this goes again to the MO of the predator. I mean, what Murphy would do, and in the Catholic context, it's especially terrifying. What Murphy would do is he would use the power of the confessional, this moment when, you know, the confessor talks to a priest about their sins. Mm-hmm. To get information about these kids, and very often he'd then pursue the kids whose parents could not sign, who are most vulnerable, which is often what predators do. You know, you want to go for the wounded.
Mm-hmm.
So it is really part of the MO of the predator, but it was all tied up with this Catholic ritual of confession. A lot of times, you know, other people in the film talk about that when you make yourself that vulnerable in confession, for somebody to use that against you is what some people call soul murder.
Yeah.
Because it takes that soul, that pureness of heart that is attempted to be given up, you know, when you're trying to, you know, communicate your sins and use it against you in a way that is murderous.
Here's another scene from the film where the men explain how they were abused. Now, I should warn our listeners, it's a little graphic. Here's another moment from the film, Mea Maxima Culpa, Silence in the House of God.
I filled out the confession form. The form listed stealing, lying, sex, and things like that. I would mark things off and turn it in. Father Murphy looked at it. And then asked me really weird questions like, have you been with other boys?
I would say, I played with myself. And he would ask detailed questions like, how? Or what did you do? And then he said, okay, I want to see you in my office this afternoon. So I said, okay, and left the booth and kneeled to pray.
He asked me, have you been playing with your penis? And I told him, no. But he gave me one of his looks. And it scared me. So I admitted that, I played with myself. He told me to pull down my pants and to do it right there. So I played with myself for a little bit. He watched me intently until I was done. Then he told me that God forgave me, and I felt like my sins had been wiped away. He could have been playing with himself for all I know. But I couldn't see.
There's a lot of really interesting kind of profound characters in the film. I want to ask about Richard Sipe, former Benedictine monk. And he makes this, I think it was 25-year study about celibacy. Talk about what he found, because his input in this film and in the story itself is really important in the way we understand what was going on. And he discovered basically not everyone in the church knew this. Not everyone was practicing celibacy.
Well, he, based on his research, which he hoped the church would find interesting, but apparently they did not.
Yeah.
Based on his research, he discovered that at least 50% of the clergy are not celibate, or actually have an active sex life. Mm-hmm. So if you have at the heart of a church like the Catholic Church a doctrine that says that everyone is celibate, but a majority of the clergy don't observe that celibacy, then you have in practice a kind of recipe for not only hypocrisy but secrecy and blackmail, which was, I think, part of what led to the cover-up. Because, you know, it's unfair really to the church to think that, you know, a few people at the top were sort of masterminding some kind of you know, magnificent cover-up because they thought of it as a wonderful crime to commit.
Yeah.
It's something that evolves out of this hypocrisy and secrecy and blackmail, so that nobody wants to talk about this stuff because it then implicates everybody else right on up the chain. And you over time develop – the institution over time right. develops a kind of protective mechanism, which is a sort of de facto secrecy that that is intended to shield everybody from the consequences of what they're really doing as opposed to what they're saying they're doing.
Mm. Sipe is like a few others in the film who, as they dig into this, their initial intentions are, I'm going to help the church solve this issue. And then there comes this kind of tipping point where they realize that that's not – that they don't share the intention with the institution itself, I guess.
Correct. It sort of reminds me of Sharon Watkins at Enron. Mm-hmm. You know, I think her initial – motivation was to help Enron. Gosh, there seems to be some kind of fraud here. Surely Enron would like to know about it. Well, it turned out that that was not the case.
There's this idea that Richard Sipes explores that priests who were abusing children had kind of created this kind of moral framework to justify it. It's a syndrome referred to in the film as noble cause corruption. Let me play another clip from Richard Sipe. He talks about this belief that good intentions purify bad behavior.
A priest who had an affair with this 12, 13-year-old girl brought to one of their encounters what he said was a consecrated host. And he touched it to her vagina. And he said, "This is how God loves you." And then he raped her. It goes from just this broad social acceptance, the priest is perfect, the pope is perfect, to this kind of perversion of power that can be twisted in this way. The system of the Catholic clergy, for which I have great respect and to which I have given many years of my life, selects, cultivates, protects, defends, and produces sexual abusers.
Now, Alex Gibney, I think I get how it defends and protects. What does he mean, produces sexual abusers?
You'd have to ask Sipe, but I think what he means is that when you create an organization that has no sense of accountability and also an organization which, again, implies this innate goodness – this idea of being set apart from normal humans, you allow transgressions to happen because there doesn't seem to be – there seems to be a disconnect between the action and the morality. It's as if you've provided everybody with their own rationalization for bad behavior. I think that's really the key here. I mean, obviously, you know, and one has to be very careful in talking about this stuff because – very often when you're talking about somebody like a Lawrence Murphy I think is a person who has a compulsive sexual disorder.
Right.
So you can't blame the institution for that. But you can blame the institution for creating an environment in which Lawrence Murphy can thrive. That you can do.
Mm.
And it becomes all the more dangerous because then Lawrence Murphy begins to take on the coloration of the institution and to come up with rationalizations for his behavior that he thinks are appropriate. I mean, we included notes from his therapist in which he says he was taking the sins of the children upon himself,
right,
as if, you know, by masturbating them, he was performing some kind of personal sacrifice rather than indulging his sexual compulsion. So that's where the role of the institution can become extremely dangerous in creating this thing, you know, the police call noble cause corruption, where you think that because you're part of an institution that is inherently good, you can't possibly do bad.
Another great figure, character I want to talk about in the film, Patrick Wall, another former Benedictine monk. You refer to him as the fixer in the film. Talk about Patrick Wall, if you would, because, again, here's another man who's charged with going and sort of fixing this problem, and he figures that's what he's doing. But at some point, it occurs to him that that's not what he's being asked to do. He's not being asked to necessarily fix it, but I guess hide it.
Correct. I mean, he thought initially that he was being sent around from parish to parish, almost like internal affairs in the police department, that he was going to go root out bad cops, expose their behavior, and then the force as a whole would be the better for it. But it turns out that what he was really doing was not only going in to try to clean things up, but also to cover them up. And he was armed with a pocket full of cash that he was allowed to present to victims, in effect, to keep them quiet. So the fixer turned out not to be the fixer, but the hider. Yeah. That's really a better description of what it was that he was doing.
It's interesting. This story starts to unravel, and Patrick Wall talks about this revelation for himself. He hadn't realized. Mind you, here was a man who had been in the church all of his life to this point, and he doesn't realize the kind of elaborate infrastructure that exists within the church to deal with what is, I guess, this regular occurrence, priests molesting children. And he talks about that. Here's another moment from the film Mea Maxima Culpa, Silence in the House of God. This is Patrick Wall.
You know, between the ages of 26 and 31, I was baptized in a very radical way to know that this wasn't an anomaly, that this was a pattern, that there are treatment centers. Before ordination, I had no idea that we had treatment centers around the world for priests to go to when they sexually molested, raped, and sodomized kids. I didn't know that. My parents didn't know that. I didn't know that we had 55 molesters in my monastery. I didn't know there were more than 70 molesters operating in the archdiocese. That wasn't public knowledge.
Alex Gibney, this is a big revelation in the film. And maybe you could talk about, I mean, they even to the point at which they decide that they consider buying an island.
Off the coast of Grenada.
Yeah.
It was called Kariku. And the idea, it was going to be like Mystery Island, except it was going to be Pedophile Island. And they were going to send all the church's pedophiles and to this one island in the Caribbean. You know, because there was one priest who felt actually, this was an order called the Servants of the Paraclete.
Right.
And the person who was running that order believed that these people really could not be reformed. They were like vipers. And there's part of his sense about that was correct. But I think that, you know, his belief that he could warehouse them in some distant place where they would pray for forgiveness was probably misguided. But nevertheless, the church clearly realized it had a huge problem on its hands, but never properly confronted it. And the bigger problem, I think, you know, one of the things that I think of when you played that clip of Wall is he said, geez, I didn't know just how big the problem was. I can't prove this, to be honest with you. But I think that when we talk about, you know, predators seeking places to be able to seek out their prey, you know, predators, I think, may have instinctively sought out the church because they sensed that they would be protected. And that, I think, is a serious problem.
Well, there's this moment in that story about the island. You know, this is this Father Fitzgerald, and he comes up with that idea. Let's buy an island for these pedophile priests, which, of course, seems ludicrous in some ways. But at least if you figure if they would have done that, there would have been a place and they would have been dealing with it in some place. But instead, what they do, I think, is telling. They decide to try to rehabilitate them and then send them back into these parishes, many of them in the same places they had been before.
I have nothing against rehabilitation if it can be accomplished. The problem is they never warned any of the victims.
Exactly.
It's as if you try to tell the great white shark. It's, look, you've eaten an awful lot of fish. Don't you think you can kind of calm down? Now, if we send you off to a special place, maybe you can come back and make nice with the fish around you. You know, it's just not going to happen. And when you put that great white in a big shark tank with a bunch of other fish, those fish are going to get eaten. It's as simple as that. So it was this failure to have any sensitivity for the victims, you know, for other children who might be abused by these molesters. That's the really shocking and horrifying thing about all of this.
Alex Gibney is with us. He directed and produced the film Mea Maxima Culpa, Silence in the House of God. The film is debuting Monday on HBO, and Wednesday of next week, Radio West and the Utah Film Center is going to be presenting a free screening. It's at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Alex is going to be joining us by Skype for a Q&A after the film. For more information, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We now continue our conversation with the filmmaker Alex Gibney. We recorded the conversation earlier today. Gibney has produced a documentary about the chronic abuse of children by Roman Catholic priests and the efforts to cover up the crimes. The film is called Mea Maxima Culpa, Silence in the House of God. And there's a moment in the film where some of the young men who were abused at a Catholic school for the deaf decide to go to the police. Gibney says that if you think about the time, this was the early 1970s, years before the story would break open, it's a remarkable act of bravery.
So far as I can figure out, Gary, Bob, and Arthur are kind of the patient zero of the protest against clerical sex abuse. So far as I know, there was no this was the first public protest against clerical sex abuse. And you have to remember, you know, in a town like Milwaukee, even the police force was extremely Catholic, and priests were revered. You know, there was one instance that was relayed to me in which, you know, Murphy was called out by one of the kids, and the police showed up at the school, and Murphy said, "Oh, you can't listen to that kid. He's retarded." And then the policeman went away. So for these kids to do it, I mean, what was really interesting is they approached it as if all the public institutions were going to support them. So first they go to the police, and the police really don't fully investigate. Then one person advises them to go to the archbishop. Once the archbishop finds out about this, surely he's going to put a stop to it and it'll all be well. And in fact, it's just the opposite. In fact, the archbishop lectures them for being so insensitive toward Father Murphy. So it's a lesson in terms of just what kind of agony you often have to go through to be a whistleblower for abuse that has come to be accepted. It really was hard for these kids and then men. I mean, they went through a process of some 20, 30 years trying to get this abuse to be recognized, to, you know, trying to tell the truth and be told over and over and over again, we don't really want to hear that truth.
We went down to the police station and went in. Bob was writing back and forth with the officer because he had good English skills. And then two police officers told us to stay in a room. And we waited and waited and waited. And I went to open the door, and the door was locked. And then two detectives came into the room and said, "You can go." And we were all excited about being able to leave and guessing that the detectives had already talked to Murphy. We waited for a week to go by, then another week went by, and then another. We didn't hear a thing. It was just sickening. Murphy had told them that it wasn't true, and the kids were making it up, that we were just little troublemakers.
It started to bother me more and more because I was hearing that he was molesting other kids. I was mad, and I wanted to protect these deaf kids, and it was time to do something about it. And we did.
Now, what they did was kind of, again, amazing for the context of the time. They create these wanted posters, these flyers, and they won't be put off. They just hand them out in all kinds of different places. Tell about that, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, they weren't getting any traction, so they decided to make it public. I mean, their motivation even then, by this time they had already left St. John's, but they were young men in their 20s, and they were determined to protect other children. So they make up these wanted posters and start putting them on cars surrounding the cathedral to draw attention to the fact that this guy Murphy is a predator. And ultimately, you know, that would finally lead to a meeting with Archbishop Cousins, who was in charge of the archdiocese at the time. But it was a striking display of gumption, really. They weren't being heard or listened to at all, and they needed to do something. So they did.
Mm. Now, we're talking about this one incident in Milwaukee, but a big part of the film is sort of how the story kind of unravels. And at first, this was dismissed as this American or this North American problem. But pretty soon, it's revealed that this is happening everywhere. And not only that is it happening everywhere in Catholic dioceses and Catholic parishes everywhere around the world, but that the church itself has known about this for a very long time.
Fourth century, you see documents about this subject. So they've known about it for a long time. And frankly, the current Pope, Pope Benedict, is perhaps the most knowledgeable person in the world about clerical sex abuse. Because as of 2001, when he was Cardinal Ratzinger and head of a thing called the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, Pope John Paul decided to make sure that every case of clerical sex abuse landed on his desk. Mm. Before that, different kinds of sex abuse would land on various people's desks, you know, in the Vatican. But John Paul decided to centralize them with Ratzinger. And so Ratzinger got them all from 2001 until he became Pope. So, you know, it's widely recognized that he may be the most knowledgeable person about clerical sex abuse in the world.
There's a big theme in the film, and it's expressed by this former Archbishop Weakland, about this idea that the way priests are viewed within the church itself and the way they see themselves. Richard Sipes talks about, for example, the way Lawrence Murphy saw himself as not just an old man at this particular moment where he's writing to say, can I just be left alone to the dignity of my priesthood? And for Richard Sipes, that's an important point because he didn't see himself as a man alone but as a priest. And that's – the distinction is important. There's a difference there.
Yes, Sipes, I believe, refers to it as a heresy within the church, the idea that a priest through holy orders, one of the sacraments that, you know, confers upon you the role of priest, that you're set above – normal mortals. You're somewhere between a human and the angels. And that this idea leads to abuses of power because you think that you're on a different plane. And you refer to the fact that, you know, Lawrence Murphy wrote to say, please let me alone. We should point out that the person he wrote to was Cardinal Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict.
Right.
And at the time, Cardinal Ratzinger was head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And the decision was made in Rome that despite the fact that finally, after all this time, there was a canonical trial, that is to say a church trial against Murphy in order to defrock him, in order to show the victims some sense of justice, that they abandoned that process because, after all, he's a priest. And I think the idea was he's part of our family and therefore we're not going to punish him. We're going to give him a break, cut him some slack. Once again, though, I think the part that the hierarchy just doesn't understand is why parishioners or the faithful would be outraged by that. The idea that the priest somehow is set above normal people, that rather than a church based on charity and love, it's based on power. Mm-hmm. And the idea that these people are set apart in some way, and so they should be immune from the justice that would normally apply to us all.
Let me play one more clip. This is former Archbishop Weakland who kind of makes an important point based on that concept.
The church is a perfect society, and it witnesses this perfect society to the rest of the world. If we could get that out of our minds, maybe we take the pedestal away from the priest take the pedestal away from the cardinals, take the pedestal away from the whole church, and be willing to say, this is us, world. This is us. This is who we are. We're a church of imperfect people. Jesus wasn't afraid of humanity, and we shouldn't be either.
Alex Gibney, let me ask you this finally. There are a lot of things we haven't talked about yet. I kind of wanted to leave some of this for people to see themselves, some really dramatic moments, some remarkable revelations. How do you explain what it is you want, you know, a film like this to accomplish? Is it about documenting abuse, or do you want there to be some sort of discrete outcome? Have you thought about that?
I have. I mean, I wanted to document abuse. I also wanted to document heroism. Yeah. I mean, I think that's part of the interest I had in these deaf men. That to me is the inspiring thing about the film. But there's also a lot to be done. I mean, honestly, we've traveled a long distance in the last 10 years in regards to the church, and consequences are being felt. I mean, now civil society has taken hold in Ireland, in a place, in a country where there was very little division for some time between church and state. You know, new rules and regulations have been put in the United States with the church, and prosecutions now are proceeding apace, including prosecutions of people for covering up crimes, not just committing crimes. But there's one one thing that I think is still outstanding in terms of holding the church to account, and that is this document trail. Because the more documents that are unveiled and released, the more we see about the scale and scope of this massive cover-up throughout the world. And so, you know, one thing that I would hope people would focus on is something very simple, which the church, of course, could do itself. And that is to disgorge all the documents, including the ones in the Vatican and in the archives of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, regarding clerical sex abuse of minors. That would be a testament to the faithful that the hierarchy really cares about their welfare. And indeed, is not putting themselves on pedestals above the rest of us, but is willing to put power aside for the sake of humanity.
Alex Gibney, next week we're offering a free screening of his film. It's called Mea Maxima Culpa, Silence in the House of God. It's part of our Through the Lens documentary series in partnership with the Utah Film Center. It's Wednesday night, February 6th at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. And don't forget, the film is debuting on HBO on Monday night. Alex Gibney, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.